If Reality Check Radio enriches your day and life, support us to keep bringing you the content, voices, perspectives, and dose of reality you won't get anywhere else. Visit www.realitycheck.radio/donate.
Welcome back to The Dialogue with Diwa de Boer on Reality Check Radio, where we discuss politics, power, and culture. You can text your thoughts on 2057 and email your questions, your thoughts, your comments to inbox@realitycheck.radio. I'm joined now by Brendan Malone, who is a world-famous in New Zealand political and cultural commentator. He does a lot of work on Christian apologetics, conference speaking, pro-life training, and other educational work. He joins us now to talk a little bit about a few key events over the past week, one here at home, two in the UK, and also one in the United States. Welcome to the show, Brendan.
There you are. That's a very kind introduction. I'm not sure I'm worthy of it. I will do my best.
Before we get into the big international stories, I'd like to get your opinion on an interview that David Seymour did with Sean Plunkett the other day. And David Seymour's describing how he wanted to clean out the public institutions. And Sean Plunkett's response was basically, all right, you're calling for a pogrom against these far left academics that have been inserted into all of these institutions that we have. And he said, I probably shouldn't use that word. And David Seymour came back and said, yeah, we'll have to call it something different. So I'm going to call it a purge today. Kind of, we need a spring cleaning, perhaps, maybe is an even nicer term. What's your general thoughts on this plan that David Seymour has?
Some part of me is tempted to say not before time. Another part of me, obviously, and I'm not a free speech absolutist, but at the same time, I'm also not someone who is triggered by words in the way that some people like to be. And I think pogrom was absolutely a very poor choice of word, because it is like I have a heart for philosophy, and you should use words correctly. We know the left don't, so conservatives should use them correctly, and those who claim not to be woke should use them correctly. And pogrom is a very specific term for an ethnic cleansing type event. So that was a bit of an oversight. But at the same time, they acknowledged it and said, let's find another word. We know what he meant. Mm-hmm. I think the question for me is, it's one thing to burn out the rats, I guess, or, cure the disease. But then what do you do with the body? The body doesn't become healthy automatically just by being rid of disease. It seems to me that there's an assumption here that, well, if we just purge all of these people, well, first of all, would our universities just collapse because there'd be no one left? But secondly, what are you going to do to build up a healthy academia? What are you going to do to ensure that that pillar of our society is actually grounded in goodness and in truth? And so that otherwise all you've done is you've just emptied the house. And then if I could be so bold as to quote Jesus in the gospel, seven more demons come along, find an empty house and take up residence. You might drive them out for a bit, but nothing really changes. And I think this is where the problem is. It's very easy to be reactionary and say, look, the woke this, the woke that. But what is the authentic vision of reality that you are proposing that is not woke and is not simply reactionary, but is actually proactively going to build a better culture? What does that look like?
That gels up perfectly with what my previous guest said, Dr. Frank Salter, who I had on the show just before. Was one of the little questions I put to him near the end as well, to say, hey, our government's doing, say they're going to be doing all these great things about doing all this cleanup. And he came back with exactly the same response that you had, which is, okay, well, what's in it for us? Who are they going to be replaced with? Are these just hollow victories? And in the end, we have no one to advocate for our interests. And all we're doing is setting ourselves up for just, like you said, the next Labour government comes along and it's seven times worse. Do we have a solutions-oriented government where they are going to actually replace these people? But like we have this first step that they're talking about, cutting funding specifically, but do you believe there are men with enough vision in this government, enough will to use power to make actual cultural changes, to actually hire people who are going to do good things instead of doing evil things?
I think there are some, but I don't think they're on the front benches. Well, it's actually one or two exemptions, but generally, I don't know if they're going to have the clout, especially with National being absolutely controlled by the liberal wing of the party at the moment. And it's just abundantly clear. I watched In fact, on my podcast earlier this week, I talked about that interview that Matt Ducey did, and he's the Minister of Mental Health. And here he is using talking points about colonization and racism being the cause of high Maori suicide rates. And that doesn't actually gel with the evidence, but it's a very common talking point you've heard from progressives for quite a number of years now. So that faction has clearly got a sway in the party. I think there's a bigger question. If you're going to fix the academy, I've been talking about this for a while, we desperately in New Zealand are lacking probably some elder statesmen who have a good conservative mana about them. Winston Peters is the closest I think we've got to that. I think also there is a sense in which there is not a strong conservative intelligentsia. And I mean authentically conservative. I don't just mean right wing. People often use those two terms interchangeably. They're not. To be on the right is not the same thing as to be authentically conservative. Authentic conservatism is about trying to conserve goodness, truth, and beauty. And so where is that intelligentsia? And so to me, that's the thing that government's got to take proactive steps. And I think others in society have got to take ownership of as well, hiring decisions and things that are made further down the food chain. And again, we come back to a problem. I know you and I have conversed on this and we have converging views on this. The managerial bureaucratic classes, they are the power behind the throne. If you've seen Lord of the Rings, you know Grima Wormtongue had the king's ear. And that's they hold the power. So what's going to happen at that level to actually ensure there's some real change? And I think that's, if they had a bit more gumption and they would say, right, we want to fix education, who are we going to replace in the Ministry of Education to ensure that the new policies coming out of that building actually reflect the changes that need to happen? You know, things like that.
And we have not yet heard anything along those lines from this government yet. They're still very much in the repeal, defund phase of things without, you know, really dealing with the root causes of the problem. I've got an example here, for instance, the way that the funding works for funding the role of Professor Joanna Kidman, who is the currently basically getting a salary as part of the Department of the Prime Minister that was set up by Jacinda Ardern. And this anti-extremist organization that she runs, supposedly, she is an incredibly extreme individual. In fact, what prompted the latest response from David Seymour is that she said here, and I quote, "I can only assume that this government hates children, most of who will be poor and brown. Plus, it wants to snatch children's lunches. Is this a government or a death cult?" And she, in the past, has tweeted many things about decolonizing New Zealand in a violent way, complaining about that everything is white supremacy and oppression. In fact, I've got an article on my website, rightminds.nz, that's getting a lot of views at the moment. And the title of that is just, "Who is Professor Joanna Kidman?" And if you just run that into Google, I'm sure you'll find my article if anybody in the audience is interested in reading that. And I go through all of her tweets and it's all the same. It's basically a kind of a blood and soil ethno-nationalism for Maori. But if that's all it were, then that wouldn't be a big problem. It's mixed in with a lot of anti-whiteness, right? A hatred for Europeans is very clear from her tweets. But then the way that she gets funded is obviously an interesting money laundering situation. And that's something that the government may have to decouple. So the money goes to the university. Basically, Victoria University Trust gets this money from the Department of the Prime Minister and then pays her salary out of that. So she says, well, I'm not paid by the government. I'm hired by the university. And then if the university comes and speaks to her, she can say, oh, my free speech is being silenced. The university is trying to take my job because of the things that I'm saying. But really, the funding for the job comes from the government. And this seems to happen throughout their entire industry, that they're basically just laundering money through NGOs, non-government organizations that are getting taxpayer funding. They're then joining up to these organizations that pay salaries for other academics to then give these far-left talking points. So another one David Seymour complained about a few days ago was the co-chair of the Health Coalition Aotearoa, and that was Dr. Lisa Te Morenga. And she said the same thing. She said, I'm glad David Seymour doesn't have children. I hope he doesn't breed. You know, congratulations, Kiwi. We have a fascist, white supremacist government. She said as well, the government has a deliberate policy to kill off all Maori who don't identify with David Seymour's visions for them. So these academics claim to be independent, but really that money is being laundered from the taxpayer.
Well, it's also too, there's a, like, these people are extremists. And look, I'm all for, I'm an Irishman. Well, my heritage is Irish. I'm a Kiwi, but my Irish heritage, I'm all for hyperbole and a good, robust debate. And, you know, I don't get too panicked by words. But the simple truth is, if you've spent your entire, the last almost 10 years in this self-built cottage industry of critiquing other people for their supposed extremist language and words, and you've interpreted the minutiae of every little syllable of every word, and what does it mean? What's the deeper, dark ideology behind it? And then you turn around and say stuff like this. I'm sorry, but you are not being consistent. You are being hypocritical. And you, in fact, are proving yourself to be exactly the sort of person that you claim to critique and be worried about. There's no social cohesion here. Mm-hmm. This is surely stochastic terrorism. Mm-hmm. It is absolutely inflammatory. There's no doubt in my mind that impressionable people could hear this and go, oh my gosh, she's right. I better do something more extreme about this. So it's none of this is helping to turn down the temperature. None of this is adult and mature. And worst of all, it's really taking place online, where I think the burden of these particular extremists' approach to issues actually gets worse, because in the online space, it just everything amplifies. If you're in a room with someone having a dialogue, a good old Irish stoush, and you get a bit full of hyperbole, you know, you deal with it, right? And it's a lot easier to manage and deal with. But online, it's like throwing dynamite into a room. And I think the question is, why should we, or why would the taxpayer, why would any rational, sane government that really cares about the common good be putting our money into allowing and platforming this kind of stuff? You want to do that on your own dime? Well, you do that on your own dime and you deal with the consequences. But to have the government funding this, to me, that's, yeah, you know, I don't care which side of the ledger you're on. If you're getting into extremism like that, there's a certain social responsibility and, I guess, moral responsibility that you have, you've completely abdicated there.
And one of the reasons why this is even in the news is obviously because the media is covering this, the media is carrying water for them and trying to defend this behavior, which, as you said, is the anti-extremist coalition is doing the extremism. And
it's funny, both hypocrisies have been exposed. So the anti-extremists have become the extremists. Well, they've shown us what the extremists they always were. And the media, who have been running articles about the problem of free speech, suddenly become the free speech absolutists. It's clear there's a revolution going on here.
Yes, I said this in last week's show. We covered it. There was a different organization that we talked about very briefly called FACT. And obviously, everything they talk about is really the opposite of facts. So it's a very common communist revolutionary tactic to name your organization the opposite of what it really is. So you often see, we're seeing it again this week, the anti-extremist task force is just about extremism. And this keeps happening every single time. But we do see, you call it hypocrisy, but really for them, it's power, right? They're just willing to you. Yeah. They don't care. You can say, oh, this is hypocritical. Imagine if the situation were reversed. They don't care. For them, it's just about power. Do we have in David Seymour, of all people, I am surprised by at least his posturing here, is that he seems to be willing to use power as well, because he's basically got the power of the purse, able to make certain demands of the taxpayer money that's being doled out. Is David Seymour the man of the hour here, who's willing to say, you know what, who cares about all of these arguments about free speech, and they're saying, calling me out as a hypocrite and blah, 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 because that's just what they do. They don't care about the argument either. And he's willing to just make it a clear case of power. They're willing to just use power to get what they want. He's going to push back and say, I'm going to use the power that I have to get what I want. Is he doing what most conservative politicians are actually afraid to do?
Yeah, I think so. And it's interesting. I'd have some big disagreements with Seymour, and he is a libertarian. I am not. I am authentically conservative. And so we'd have straight away philosophical differences around how society should be structured, whether the individual or the community actually should be considered the primary, you know, unit or source of society. But I think he's absolutely, in the last few weeks, he's shown himself to actually be capable of enunciating and acting more like a conservative. So we saw this, was it last week, when he talked about he was fronting the government policy on gang patches. And he made the very conservative argument that, in actual fact, this is not so much about free speech. It's about the fact that this insignia is a form of intimidation, and it exists. These groups exist to do harm to the common good. And so you can't actually just let people who are going to do harm to the common good run riot and hope for the best. You know, you can't just sort of reason your way out of it in the marketplace of ideas. Sometimes you've actually got to have laws that restrict evil. Here he is again on this point, sort of saying exactly what the conservative position is, that you should be free to engage in legitimate acts of self-expression. So religious ideas, philosophical ideas, political ideas, or, you know, you might say lower tier ideas where the government has no place being, you know, conversation in the family home, things like that. But you don't, that right is not absolute. You don't get to say whatever you want to. And so there's a very conservative position there. Here's what I think is actually going on, though. I think he's being very, this is political self-interest, I think. At the end of the day, it's a big factor in all this. He's a very wily politician in the sense that, you know, typical politician is astute of his own, you know, constituency and his own power base. And I think what's going on is he's realized, I've actually got to be, I've got to outwit Winston Peters. And I think he's trying to do, I think he's put his hat on and thought, what would Winston Peters do? Say, I'll do that.
He is, because this is my complaint about Winston Peters, is that he talks a good talk during the election campaign. He gets in and then he goes overseas. Like he's a good foreign minister. He's a good foreign minister, but that means he's not really putting New Zealand first. He's, you know, doing international diplomacy, which is important and I'm sure prestigious work for him, but it means that we get stuck with nothing happening. And like you said, David Seymour is the one who's put on his thinking cap and said, what if I'm going to be the Winston Peters at home and Winston Peters is going to be the Winston Peters overseas? And hopefully that's what's going on here. And I guess we'll see how that plays out in the coming months throughout the year.
Do you know what else I think is a factor? Is I think you've seen this, whether they're progressive or they are on the right of center. The only exception I think would be the Greens, because they just, I think the Greens are revolutionary and they're inept. And not like they were under Rod Donald. They've changed radically. And I think if they got into power, they would not know what to do with power. But I think every other party, what happens is you get into power and the realities of having the books on your hand, the public purse, the laws, all of that, all of a sudden you have to become a little bit more conservative in your take. And you might be a brand, you know, firebrand of a libertarian or a firebrand of progressive on the campaign trail, but as soon as you get into power, all of a sudden you actually have to temper that a bit because you realize the reality of having to wear the crown is a lot different. And I think conceivably that's what's happening with Seymour here as well. He's realizing, there are other realities at play here. You can't just live as a libertarian and govern as a libertarian. You've actually, you've got to do more than that.
One of the big stories of the week, I've already covered a little bit. I did ask my previous guest about this too. But it was a big story from the United Kingdom that a man by the name of Sam Melia was imprisoned for 2 years for putting up stickers that the courts deemed to be offensive, and that his intent of putting these stickers in was to stir up racial strife and so on. The stickers themselves were really not that bad. I'll just read out a couple of and he made hundreds of them, but here's five or six of them. He said, reject white guilt. It's okay to be white. We will be a minority in our own homeland by 2066. White lives matter. Stop anti-white rape gangs. Love your nation. And there's a very small sample of stickers that were hundreds of them, very, very similar to this. He was imprisoned for 2 years for doing this. And his wife is Laura Towler from Patriotic Alternative, who's 8 months pregnant. He's got a toddler as well at home that she has to look after while he's in jail. And I was actually hoping to get her on the show this morning, but we had a 13-hour time zone difference. And, you know, she's had a toddler, 8 months pregnant. You can tell that it was just too difficult to match things up. But that's why I've got you here as the fallback guy. You know, this happens. You have your best plans for the show, and then it all, you adapt at the last minute. So this is actually something the UK has a history of, basically jailing conservative protesters or persecuting people who are objecting to, whether it's policies of mass migrations or whether it's bans on protesting outside abortion clinics. There's a big couple of big cases on that last year. They keep cracking down on effectively conservative protesters against what is a conservative government in the UK.
It's an interesting case. There's definitely views that he espouses that I personally find morally unacceptable and would happily debate him on. But in this specific case, I look at this and I think, hold on a minute. See, there's two principles at stake for me here. One is judicial consistency. If your judiciary does not have integrity, it doesn't have the trust of the people, and that's a very dangerous thing. And it doesn't look like the rule of law, and it certainly doesn't look like, it just isn't rule of law. It's rule by law. So when you've got Hamas protesters on the streets who are also saying anti-Semitic things and race-based protests and all the rest of it, and you're saying, turn a blind eye, and even you're encouraging it, and then you turn around and you say, let's imprison this man for what we deem to be pretty much a similar sort of crime, stirring up supposed racial dissension, right, between peoples, then there's a problem there straight away. There's something, and funnily enough, when people, you talked about the English judiciary and what's been going on, people talk about judicial activism, and they tend to think, oh yes, America, Supreme Court. But in actual fact, you're right, there's been some fascinating cases out of England. I mean, 3-4 years ago, there was a case, absolutely shocking case, where a judge, there was an intellectually disabled adult woman who got pregnant. Her Christian mother wanted to keep and raise the baby herself, and the court ordered her to have a forced abortion. And they said, we will provide this intellectually disabled adult woman with the baby doll as a replacement. And it's absolutely shocking. And thankfully, that case went public and some other lawyers got involved and they appealed it. And the appeals court said, there's no way you can do this. Now, it turns out that particular judge in the lower court had been for many years prior as an attorney, as a lawyer, had worked for various pro-abortion choice advocacy groups. So you see this judicial activism happening. So it's not just an American problem, and it's something even we in New Zealand should be aware of. But the other big principle here, and I think the English should be very aware of this because English common law really wrote the book on this, as far as I can tell, was the idea that your punishments should never be excessive. For example, if you're going to institute a fine for something, the fine should not be, like, if you're an elderly pensioner, you get fined $1 million. That's an absurdity. It's an injustice in and of itself. If you are going to punish someone with jail time, it should be a proportionate response. And I'm not convinced that this is a proportionate response. And like you say, the harm to his family, but also the fact that he will be at risk inside that prison system. And so are they going to put him in solitary confinement, or are they going to leave him in the general population where he will be, his life will be at risk of assault at the very least, possibly worse. And so I look at this whole situation, and I think 2 years in jail, to me, this is excessive. And I think even more of an issue is really the question of, if you're trying to solve serious social issues like this, this is the worst way you can do it, because you know what you'll do? You will now actually generate, I think, more interest and potentially people coming to his cause, and actually then you'll see some real negative problems off the back of it. So I can't comprehend how this makes sense. Even if you want to say, look, let's fight the problem of racial dissension in our society, great, that's a worthy cause, but this is not the way to do that.
This probably comes back to the infiltration of the institution that we've been talking about this morning, with all of these different institutions in our society that have had a long march of Marxists, this ideology that is very much opposed to conservatism, anything that is right wing, or anything that is not communist, really, anything that's not communistic, they're opposed to. And that's what they're willing to punish. And so you have these judges making these decisions because they're so heavily influenced by this ideology. It's just pure ideology at play. And like you said, they're not worried about the consequences. You mentioned people rallying to his cause. I did see his wife say that they had, in the 24 hours after his imprisonment, they had a 300% increase in interest in joining their organization, their patriotic alternative group. And it's gone international. Obviously, this is a big boost for them as a group and their cause, because one of their men has been made a martyr. He's been thrown in prison for this cause. And yet the judges, they don't care, because they think, I'm just going to administer punishment to these people one by one. You know, the more of them there are, the more that we'll just try them, you know.
Well, they're playing whack-a-mole, right, at that point, and they just keep popping up. And what's even more bizarre is you'd have to say, well, what's the tangible harm? I've read different sources, people who are staunchly opposed, people who are trying to defend, and I'm trying to get to the bottom of, well, what actual tangible harm was done? Like that's the key question. Like, if it seems to me that I don't know as much about English sentencing, but it seems that he's been given a sentence that possibly people who commit physical assaults on the streets of England wouldn't get. And that does not make any sense at all. Surely you've got to show that there is a tangible, substantial, and, you know, a reasonable degree of harm that A, has happened, and or B, you have to prevent. And the only way to do that to protect society would be jail time. And I don't think that test has been met, surely.
No, it clearly has not been met. Like you've said, I cannot find a single person who has made a coherent case that somehow this sentence could be seen to be just in any way. I've seen that they've done a couple of fundraisers as well, you know, to provide for his family while he's in prison. I've seen his wife say that hopefully he'll be out on parole fairly quickly, because obviously, the just like in New Zealand prisons, if you behave yourself well, you can be let out fairly quickly. So that seems to be a possibility that at least he won't be in there for so long. But it seems to be a clear case that has to be appealed, because you couldn't get a case like, or at least I wonder, thinking, oh, you couldn't get a case like this in New Zealand. But now I do kind of wonder, because you see the slack sentencing that you get in the UK. You mentioned physical assault. I've seen a case by the very same judge that sentenced Sam Melia several years ago. He let somebody off for sexual assault, basically. So you can be a rapist and get, you know, home detention, community service, blah, blah, blah. Similar kind of situation in New Zealand, right? Where we had a case this week with a man who assaulted a 70-year-old woman. He was basically, you know, well, that was very naughty, now off you go kind of situation. Yeah. That seems to be very common for actual assaults, actual violence, genuine harm. And then you get these bizarre cases where they're cracking down on political dissent, essentially.
Well, there's two things that strike me here. Number one is, I think they've already, that they are drawing from a previous playbook here. And that was the Tommy Robinson situation. They did this to Tommy Robinson as a tool to get him out of society. And I suspect this is what they've done here. But what they've done is they've just applied it as this blunt force tool, right? And I think in this case, it's just like Tommy Robinson already had profile. This guy didn't have profile. They've given him profile that he did not have, international profile. Tommy Robinson had all that. This guy didn't. They've now given it to him. They're assuming that everyone they treat like Tommy Robinson, it will break their back and break their spirit and they'll go away. Well, I don't think that is true. And yeah, I think what's happening more and more, and we see this in New Zealand as well. So this case, I think, is a case where things are completely out of order from a perspective of virtue. They've failed in fundamental virtues and justice has not been satisfied here. But then you get the other extreme where justice is not satisfied because there's a misguided and inauthentic mercy that is applied. And it's not authentically mercy and it's not authentically justice. And so what you end up with is a situation where more and more it seems judges are almost becoming like soothsaying mind readers. They will look into the mind of an offender and they will tell society what they believe was really going on, what their real intent was. And I'm like, I'm not sure how you can actually judge that in any meaningful, coherent way. It feels like what we should be just doing is going back to the fundamental, rudimentary basics of justice. You committed a crime. What was the crime? How serious was it? What does the law say? What situation are you in? Should be the other mitigating factors. Then you pass sentence. You don't sit there and play this game of, well, you know, I really do think that there was this and there was that, and you probably are well-meaning, and I trust that you won't do this again, so on your way, son. To me, that's, we're moving further and further away from authentic justice there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that is increasingly transparent now, I believe, with sentencing. It really are judges as mind readers saying, you had hatred and malice in your heart, you go to prison, or you were a poor man who had a tough childhood, you know, you need to go away. And this is an absolutely insane way to run a justice system. And I'm going to ask you, how is this happening after 15 years of a conservative government? This goes into the second UK item I wanted to discuss just very briefly, which was that there was a by-election in the UK and a man by the name of George Galloway, who's a famous communist in the United Kingdom, and his Workers' Party had a crushing defeat over the Labour and Conservative Party in the UK. Like he got more votes than them three times over or something. Just an absolutely crushing defeat for these main parties. And how have you got to this point? You've had the UK Conservatives running the government for 15 years. On current polling, they would land 17 seats out of, what is it, 650 or so. Yeah. 17 seats. We call this the zero seat strategy of the UK Conservatives. They're aiming for zero seats, making everybody hate them. Because how do you get rulings like this that we've seen in the case of Sam Elia? How do you get somebody like George Galloway elected? Because what's the platform he's getting elected on? He's getting elected on opposing the war in Gaza, appealing very much to the Muslim vote because the 30% of the population in the seat is Muslim. All of these people have arrived basically in the last 15 years of the so-called conservative government. And they've created a constituency for this guy that he's able to appeal also to, say, working class white people who aren't getting anything from the conservative government either. You've got this basically conservative communist, if we can call him that, where he's appealing to family values. He's going to voters and saying, I oppose the woke. I'll stand up for women's rights. I'll oppose the transgender movement. And then he'll go to the Muslims and say, hey, I'm going to bring peace to Gaza and so on. And he can cobble together the most bizarre collection of votes. None of these circumstances that he has found himself as an MP in now would have been possible without the conservative government making it their policy in the last 15 years. So are we destined to be losers? How could they do this to us?
No, these people are not authentically conservative parties. It's just that simple. I bang my head on a brick wall all the time because we get it from both ends. There's people from within who say, what's happened to our conservative parties? They're not doing the job. They're failing. What's going on? Conservatism doesn't work. And then you get people from outside who look at right-wingers and they blame, you know, every right-winger is a conservative, so that we get blamed for everything that's not conservative as well. And the problem is that they have actually been little more than, I think, in most cases, liberals. Mm-hmm. And probably also very economically corrupted liberals. They've given themselves over to economic interests and various, I guess, power players that helped to put them into power as well. None of that has helped the common man. Galloway is clearly an astute political operator. He was putting different messages out to different groups that were, you'd have to say there were some polar opposites going out to different groups, but that's very astute. He says, well, I need 100 votes from these people. What do they need to hear from me? I need 100 votes from those people. What do they need to hear from me? And if they clash, who cares? I'll tell them what they need to hear. You're right. He's actually, in his mind, he's clearly trying to conserve something. And you do get that sense. He's also clearly got a bit of an orator's gift and probably the Irish background, right? I saw the interview where he just said, well, look, when they challenged him, because one of the interesting things was Rishi Sunak, wasn't it, who came out and said straight away, oh, this is gave a podium speech outside number 10 about what a dark day this was, like they've just elected Hitler or something. And I'm thinking, no, that's not what's going on. And then when the media cornered him about it, Galloway, he said, well, look, he didn't get elected. You know, people didn't vote for him. And it was just sort of sat him on his backside and said, look, it's not simply a matter of they're not listening to the people. It's they don't stand for anything. And that's the problem. This is why conservatives who have been co-opted and corrupted by liberals, they think that if they just make themselves bland into an everyman party, they'll get the votes. That's why what happens is progressives get in because they actually stand for something. And people will get pulled into it and they say, well, they stand for something, I vote for them. And then they realize that often, like Jacinda Ardern, it's just terrible, the outcomes. And so they're like, in desperation, vote them out. But what's needed is these parties need to recognize, well, what are we actually supposed to be conserving? The problem is, I think they don't know because they have lost touch with that sacred, transcendent sense of reality, that religious Christian underpinning that gave them a sense of what they were supposed to conserve. What are the fundamental goods? And so now that leaves you with what? Your own interests and your own power. And that is never going to be a recipe, a winning recipe at all. And they have failed to actually recognize they're not just opponents of progressives. And they are certainly not supposed to be there just to satisfy the interests of big business. They're there to actually serve goodness and truth. And the problem is they've lost sight of that. And so, this is the inevitable result of that.
One last very quick question that fits in, and it's a completely different story, but I think it fits in with a lot of what you've been saying at the end here, is a few weeks ago now, nearly 2 weeks ago, there was a man who burned himself alive for the Palestinian cause. His name was Aaron Bushnell. He was a dedicated Marxist, and he was serving in the United States Air Force. He went to the local Israeli embassy, and he poured petrol over himself, and he set himself on fire in a protest against what he said is the genocide happening in Gaza. We're now nearly 2 weeks on, and he seems to be forgotten, right? The kind of short-lived nature of the internet, and the people have moved on. But he killed himself for a cause that was on the other side of the world. Like, he wanted to die for something. And what would drive someone to do this? And how, like, how have we got to the point where people are doing what Aaron Bushnell did?
Well, it's a tragedy. That's the first thing to acknowledge. This is an absolute tragedy in so many ways. A young man who had so much potential and promise and obviously had a heart for people goes and self-immolates himself out, the most futile act of self-destruction ever. And what was even worse was to see people trying to glorify his actions, which is never good because that will obviously tempt others to do the same foolish thing. And then thirdly was, even most distressingly for me, was seeing Christian commentators trying to say, well, this is just like Jesus Christ. It's the exact opposite. It's not an act of self-giving love for, you know, in the hope of fruitful salvation of the world. It's political messiahship. And it's a total sort of loss of hope and despair. If I set myself on fire, maybe that'll save the world. It's just the worst thing ever. The crazy thing is, this won't actually bring positive change. It's cost a human life. It points to, I think, the dangers of radicalization. We hear all about the dangers of radicalization supposedly from the right, but no one talks about the dangers of radicalization from the left. I don't want to blame this on mental illness because I think that becomes the far too easy sort of catch-all, get-out-of-jail-free card. Not everything. We tend to pathologize everything since Freud, but not everything is a mental health issue, and you can't blame it on that. People do have autonomy and they do have agency. But I certainly think you can talk about radicalization. This man clearly, in an online soup of constant noise and drumbeats around Gaza and Israel, has clearly bought into these ideas. And then he's thought that if I set myself on fire, this is a good and right thing to do, and it will somehow bring change. And it won't do anything of the sort. You're right. He is very quickly being forgotten. We've had people do this previously who no one even knows the name of. And I think he will be one of those chaps who sadly goes down in history like that. But the madness of seeing this celebrated and talked about, and you clearly see a lack of perspective here. A man who's on the other side of the world from these incidents who thinks that this is his cause and this is how he saves the world. The truth is, if you want to save the world, you've got to start by actually living a more virtuous life yourself, your speech, your conduct. You do that, you change the world for the better. And that's the only thing you can do. But here's a man who's been so globalized that he thinks that if I do this thing in America, I'm going to fix global problems. It's such an awful, horrific tragedy in so many ways. And I think the sadness is it's to me, this is like the ultimate act of nihilistic hellish, like literally you set yourself on fire to try and purely for politics and nothing more, nothing that, you know, you're not running into a burning building to save children. It's just, you haven't helped a single person in Gaza by doing
that. Yeah, a tragic story there. And my final thought on there, I think, is, in talking about change that's needed, really lasting change is about building and not burning. You're not going to change the world by burning something down. You're going to have to build something up and work towards the solutions to very real problems that you have in your life and not ones that you think exist on the internet.
That's a really great point. And I think that's perfect in the sense that you're right. That is the revolutionary spirit, right? We burn everything down and then somehow from the ashes, the utopian belief is we'll build a better world. And in this case, the revolutionary spirit literally caused this man to destroy his very own self. And that's often, again, that is metaphorically, that's exactly what happens when you get involved in these revolutionary political salvation movements. They literally burn you. They immolate you and your authentic humanity. And we see this time and time again. And sadly, this man was a very real and literal outworking of that, just that awful reality. So what are you conserving? What are you building? That's what matters.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you for your insights this morning. I very much appreciate you coming on the show. And please let people know how they can find your work as well. If they've been listening to you just for the first time, how do they find Brendan Malone and keep in touch with them?
Well, one thing they can do is they can go to my website, Watch LFM. That's Left Foot Media. So watchlfm.com, and you'll see my podcast episodes on there and my socials. I'm on Twitter, the Dispatches podcast. Check that on all the usual platforms. And we've got a free-to-air and a subscriber-only version as well. So if you're interested in you've enjoyed the dulcet tones of my voice and you think, oh, I like the cut of that guy's jib, then that's a good place to go and hear a crazy Irishman share his views with the world.
And I actually have a monthly appearance on your podcast as well. Let the audience know. I think it's next, I'm slotted in next week sometime.
You are indeed.
So once a month, I fill Brendan in on, you know, what the coalition government has been up to with my coalition tracker. And I'll do an update on my the dialogue for that as well for you guys at some point in the future. But this is all that we have time for today. So thank you very much for your time, Brendan. And to the audience, just a final reminder, you can send your feedback, your questions to me. And I'll get to it next week. And that's it for now. Thank you, Brendan.
Thanks, Dewa.
Thank you for tuning in to RCR Reality Check Radio. If you like what you're listening to, dislike what you're listening to, either way, we want to hear from you. Get in touch with us now. You can text us with your message to 2057. That's 2057. Or email us at inbox@realitycheck.radio. We would love to hear from you. So connect with us today.